this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of ferment and flux in that part of Africa, spearheaded by Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. It's not only the ferment and flux in those three particular nations, it's their influence.
Legendary historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn analyzes the progress of the anti-imperialist Sahel Alliance of Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali, and other developments on the African continent.
It cannot be constitutional to deprive people of food and endanger their lives in order to coerce them to come out of a mineshaft simply to make arrests.
Up to 1,000 artisanal miners are now occupying an abandoned gold mine shaft in South Africa, and the government has denied them food, water, and medicine.
We have Amazon's biggest West Coast air hub just two, three weeks ago. Out of 1,500 warehouse workers, they got 800 signed up, right, and they're still getting more.
An Amazon worker speaks out about the conditions that they face and their struggle for a union.
Bilal has dedicated himself not only to expressing culturally struggle for African liberation, but also by working studiously in building organizational solidarity around Black political prisoners.
And we pay tribute to Bilal Sunni Ali, Black Panther Party member, former political prisoner, and member of Gil Scott-Heron's Midnight Band. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Block Report's J.R. Valray interviewed the legendary historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn about President Biden's recent trip to Angola and its relationship to the exploitation by the West of DRC's mineral wealth. They also discussed the genocide in Sudan, the DRC's lawsuit against Apple, and the progress of the anti-imperialist Sahel Alliance of Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali.
Angola has been big in the news lately. After Biden's last trip as the American president to an African country, where he proposed linking the mineral mines of the DRC to the shipping ports of Angola via railway to more efficiently exploit the resources of the Congo. Also in Angola, the president of the DRC, Felix Tshisekedi, was supposed to begin peace talks with Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, who didn't even bother to show up to the talks about ending a genocidal war that has already accumulated 10 million dead over the span of the conflict. What are your thoughts on Angola's pivotal role in international politics currently?
Well, this is nothing new. You may recall that during the bad old days of the African slave trade, Angola was a hunting ground for enslaved Africans, and indeed, a disproportionate percentage of Black Americans actually are Angolan Americans. You may also recall that in Louisiana, as we speak, in the Deep South, there's Angola State Prison. Now, it's controversial to suggest that this state prison was carrying the name of the Southwest African country, and now houses a significant percentage of what might be called Angolan Americans. And fast forward to 1975, when Angola was surging to independence, and the U.S. was involved in a rather diabolical plot to block that independence under the leadership of the now ruling party, the MPLA, the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, in conjunction with apartheid South Africa. Of course, they were defeated, not least because of the assistance from Cuban troops under Comandante Fidel Castro. In any case, that brings us to the current moment, where U.S. imperialism feels that it is in some sort of contestation with the People's Republic of China. And that was the underlying reason for Mr. Biden's trip to Southwest Africa. However, you may also know that Angola's trade with China is about eight times the size of U.S. trade. And this building of the so-called Lobito Corridor, which, as you noted correctly, is designed to extract the mineral wealth from that part of Africa and transported across the Atlantic to the United States, is part of this larger scheme of contestation with the People's Republic of China. In any case, the leader of Angola, President Lourenco, was sufficiently diplomatic and tactful, not to mention the attempt in 1975 by U.S. imperialism to block Angola's independence, although this other episode that I mentioned, that is to say the looting and plundering of the human capital of Angola in order to fuel economic development of the United States, particularly in the 19th century, that was underscored when Mr. Biden visited the museum in Luanda that depicts and details the history of enslavement in that part of Africa.
Apple is being sued again by the Democratic Republic of Congo for buying conflict minerals from Rwanda and Uganda, using third parties to escape the corporate accountability for employing slave labor in the Congo. The last case, which was a couple of months ago, the lawsuit failed, where Apple was being accused, and we know it's true, of using child slave labor. What do you think about this current case, and what do you think about the impact that it should have on the brand Apple worldwide?
Well, obviously, it should cast serious credibility on the brand of Apple worldwide. But as with Angola, the neighbor of Congo, this has a rather sordid and seeming history. That is to say that Congo, too, was a hunting ground for enslaved Africans. And not only that, but recall as well the recently released documentary film, which I highly recommend, Soundtrack of a Coup d'Etat, that talks about the assassination of the first leader of independent Congo, speaking of Patrice Lumumba, circa January 1961, at the behest of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, not least because Mr. Lumumba was seeking to block neocolonial incursions into his nation, the Congo, which is larger in territory than Western Europe. It's not only Apple that is sharpening its sword in order to plunder the riches of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Keep in mind that Congo is also a source of various minerals that are essential for the smooth functioning, or the functioning at all, of the economies of the advanced capitalist countries led by the United States of America. I should also say that the United States is not the only country that's involved in this kind of plunder. There's the former colonial ruler that is Belgium. There is Israel. There are Israeli nationals who are quite essential to the exploitation and plundering of the wealth of the DRC. There is, of course, France, which was a former colonial master in the neighboring Congo, speaking of Congo Brazzaville, as opposed to the Congo we're talking about, Congo Kinshasa, the larger Congo. Congo Brazzaville, of course, is just across the Congo River from the larger Congo, and France was the colonial master there for decades. So there are many fingers of accusation to be pointed when it comes to making an indictment of the North Atlantic imperialist countries for their shameless plundering exploitation of this sprawling African nation.
One of the other biggest genocides that is largely being ignored by the media is the war in the Sudan. Can you give us some history behind the conflict, and what role has the United States and the United Arab Emirates been playing in the conflict?
Even though we routinely refer to Ghana in West Africa as the first African nation to surge to independence post-1957, that is to say, Ghana coming to independence in March 1957, actually, it is preceded by the Sudan in 1956. And there hangs a tale, because for the longest, particularly in the 19th century, once again, Sudan was shamelessly exploited, not only by Great Britain, but there was a kind of condominium that involved not only Great Britain plundering Congo, but also the neighbor to the north, speaking of Egypt. This was quite a handicap when it came to independence, and it also influenced what became a striking element of post-independence Sudanese history, which is this apparent conflict between the supposedly Muslim North and the supposedly non-Muslim South that led to then U.S. President George W. Bush helping to engineer the split of southern Sudan from the largest Sudan. Until that moment, Sudan was the largest country by territory on the continent of Africa. After the split, that was no longer the case, and there is still bad blood, I'm afraid to say, between South Sudan, an independent country, and the larger Sudan. And that is the backdrop for the current conflict, which your question references. That is to say, in many ways, an internal conflict involving the Sudanese military. The Sudanese military battling a wing of the military, the so-called Rapid Support Forces, the equivalent of, say, the Navy SEALs of the U.S. military, a specialized wing of the Sudanese military. They have been battling, and as your question suggests, the United Arab Emirates has been heavily involved in this conflict, helping to support the Rapid Support Forces. Your audience will not be surprised to find out that mineral wealth is in part at the root of this conflict. Your audience also will not be surprised to ascertain that U.S. imperialism, along with its ally in Israel, are playing a malign role in this conflict because Sudan has an outlet to the Red Sea. And as we speak, going further south along the Red Sea, which abuts the eastern coast of Africa, you'll find that across from the eastern coast of Africa is Yemen. And there we find that Ansar Allah, or the Houthis as they're called in this part of the world, have been involved in a conflict with Israel and U.S. imperialism. Indeed, you might have heard about the crash of U.S. pilots into the Red Sea just in the last day or two as they were battling Ansar Allah. Ansar Allah has fundamentally shut down the Israeli port of Eilat because of their bombarding of this Israeli port. It also has compromised the ability of Egypt to collect revenue from ships sailing through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal, which Egypt controls. And as a result of these commercial and geopolitical interests, that has attracted the malignant attention of U.S. imperialism and the United Arab Emirates and, of course, Israel. It's going to be complicated further by the apparent triumph in Damascus, Syria, of religious zealots backed by Turkey and the United States, because with this apparent triumph of these religious zealots, you're going to see an escalating conflict between Turkey and Israel, and perhaps even Turkey and the United States of America, because the United States of America is supporting Syrian Kurds, which Turkey sees as a mortal threat to Turkey itself, and that in turn will cause these outside powers to get involved in that part of Africa, not only the Sudan, which is noted abuts the Red Sea, but also further south and to the east in terms of Somalia, where Turkey plays a major role. It's just across the Red Sea, once again, from Yemen. Recall that Ethiopia, a giant on the African continent, had managed to broker an agreement with the breakaway Somali province of Somaliland to establish an outlet to the sea, which outraged the larger Somalia based in Mogadishu, where, as noted, Turkey plays the major role. And it was thought that that would bring Ethiopia and Somalia into conflict until on December 11th, an agreement was brokered by Turkey, believe it or not, in order to soothe tensions between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa. But that particular accord does not necessarily address what we entered into discussion a moment or two ago. That is to say, this bleeding wound that is Sudan, with flames being fanned by outside forces, not least the United Arab Emirates.
When you look at what's going on in the Sahel region with Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger kicking French troops out of their nations, nationalizing precious metals and mineral mines, building refineries, and going after the heads of multinationals. And when you look at them doing specific things, such as Air France suspended flights to Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger recently. Then once Air France started feeling the economic pressure, they wanted to return. The Sahel Alliance reneged on that. Ghana also has broken away from ECOWAS, and it has said that it is possibly going to join the Sahelian Alliance, also along with Chad. What are your thoughts about what's going on in the Sahel region?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of ferment and flux in that part of Africa, spearheaded by Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. It's not only the ferment and flux in those three particular nations, it's their influence, which has spread westward into Senegal, which has fed anti-French neocolonial plots in Dakar, which has also spread east into N'Djamena, into Chad, where the military rulers also have booted out the French forces, just as they have been booted out of the Sahel nations aforementioned. But keep in mind that France is not reclining recumbent as these nations are moving against its neocolonial interests. You might have noticed the visit to Paris by President Tinubu of Nigeria, who was feted and garlanded by President Macron in Paris. However, if the idea that has been bruited of France replacing its military footprint in the Sahel by establishing a military footprint in Nigeria, inevitably that will destabilize the government in Abuja. You might also have noticed that just a few days ago, there was Cyclone Chido in Mayotte, a French colonial territory in the Indian Ocean. President Macron flew there and, of course, was hooted and jeered by the Africans who feel that they need to loosen, if not eradicate altogether, a French colonial rule. But I mention that because Mr. Macron seized the opportunity to fly into Addis Ababa after visiting Mayotte. And what you are beginning to suspect and see is that France is going to try to outflank its former colonial assets in the Sahel, extending, of course, eastward into Chad, by extending or forming deeper influence in the two giants of Africa, speaking of Nigeria and Ethiopia. I don't think that this kind of maneuvering is going to work, but certainly we must keep a close and careful eye on this. And I'm happy to see that you mentioned Ghana, which is the site of a major community of Black Americans on the continent. And in Ghana, you had a recent election where John Mahama, a former president, returned to power. He can fairly be considered an ideological descendant of founding father Kwame Nkrumah, who delivered independence to Ghana in 1957. One, at least those in your audience, may salute and cheer the arrival in state power of John Mahama, but at the same time, it's going to complicate relations with Washington, which may feel that its toehold, its foothold in Ghana, including establishing a kind of military footprint in that West African nation, may be compromised by the return to power of John Mahama, which inevitably will lead to further and deepening CIA intrigue in that part of Africa.
That was author and historian Dr. Gerald Horn speaking to Block Report's J.R. Valray.
Mind control. thoughts. Destruction of your soul.
That was Stephen Marley, Mind Control. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. In South Africa, artisanal miners are not employed by a mining company. They dig ore with their own tools and sell it to mining companies, or more often, middlemen. Up to 1,000 artisanal miners are now occupying an abandoned gold mine shaft in South Africa, and the government has denied them food, water, and medicine. It says that the miners are violating a law against artisanal mining and that it plans to arrest them. Julie Eccles is a South African activist who has been working at the Stilfontein mine to support the miners with food and help to end the increasingly desperate situation.
I've been on site several times. I've been working with other activists who are also going on site. And us as activists, we've been engaging with Makua, Mining Affected Communities United in Action. Makua is the most key organization on the ground in Stilfontein. If you want to know what's really going on, Makua is your best source of information. What's happening at Stilfontein is a crime against humanity. It is the deliberate starvation and mass murder of hundreds, if not thousands, of people at Shaft 11. The police are repeatedly saying that miners can leave. That is not true. They're making it sound as if the miners don't want to leave, don't want to be rescued, don't want to exit the shaft. That is not true. It's not true. Shaft 11 is 2 kilometers down vertically. It's a vertical shaft, cylindrical shape with a smooth concrete wall. There's no lift. There are no stairs. There's no ladder. It's 2 kilometers until you get to the bottom of Shaft 11. The miners are trapped at 1.6 kilometers and 1.7 kilometers to the best of our knowledge. There's no way out. The police keep saying that the miners who are trapped at Shaft 11 can exit through Shaft 10. That is not true, and I'll explain later why that is not true. Shaft 10, if anything, is even worse than Shaft 11. So what happened is that the state decided to enact Vala Mgodi, which means plug the hole. They did this as a crackdown on so-called illegal mining, and it's a nationwide project. How this ever got signed off by the Department of Minerals, the Department of Police, and the presidency, I will never know, because it cannot be constitutional to deprive people of food and endanger their lives in order to coerce them to come out of a mine shaft simply to make arrests. What this amounts to is torture and murder, a slow murder of starving people to death, which is an incredibly painful way to die. They have denied life-saving medicines, ARVs, blood pressure medication, and they have left these miners in a situation where I would be very surprised if they're not dying of cholera, because there's absolutely no sanitation products. There are no batteries for the headlights. So people are just stuck in the dark. So we have to talk about how deep 2 kilometers is, or 1.6 kilometers, which is where the miners are. If you were to walk 1.6 or 1.7 kilometers from your house, you would walk or you would drive, and you would look back at your house and you wouldn't be able to see it. That means that when the miners, if they were to look up, they wouldn't even be able to see the sky as a speck. That's how deep underground they are. There's no light there. The police have denied batteries for the headlamps. That means that the people down there are in total darkness. They're in total darkness. That's a form of torture. Sensory deprivation is a form of torture, and it will drive you mad. Let's talk about why the miners cannot exit at Shaft 10 and why they cannot exit at Margaret Shaft. Margaret Shaft belongs to another mine. It's not connected to Shaft 11 in any way. It's not connected. There is no route from Shaft 11 to Shaft Margaret underground. When the police say this, they are contradicting what's in the court papers and what we know. Let's talk about Shaft 10. The miners can't exit at Shaft 10. Shaft 11 and 10 are connected through a maze, a labyrinth of underground tunnels that you can easily get lost in. In order to get from Shaft 11 to Shaft 10, you would have to crawl, climb, walk, wade through water for at least 3 days. It's incredibly dangerous. There are rock falls. You can get lost and never find your way back. It takes 3 days of crawling, climbing, wading to get from Shaft 11 to Shaft 10. But that's not even the worst of it. When you get to Shaft 10, you are 1.4 kilometers underground. And the way that miners have been getting from where they are to the surface is by climbing an old guardrail. So there was a lift there before. That lift is gone. It's just the guardrail left. And there's nothing to grip onto that guardrail with. It's just a vertical metal structure. And they have to climb 1.4 kilometers vertically with nothing to grip onto. And there's water spraying into the shaft. There's methane gases floating around, which will make you dizzy. These are people who are so sick and emaciated, they look like they just came out of a concentration camp. They're dizzy. They don't have the strength. They don't have the fortitude to climb. They barely react, you know, when you speak to them or when there's something in front of them, they barely react. They're so sick. They're so starved. They're dehydrated. It's now up to them to climb 1.4 kilometers. Can you climb even 2 meters? Can you climb even 1 meter vertically on a metal pole? So then they have to climb. It takes 3 days of climbing to get from where they are to the top. And they have to tie themselves to that metal structure to rest from time to time. They have to take rope and tie their bodies to the pole to sleep so that they can carry on climbing. And when they wake up, their circulation is gone. They have to wait 2 hours for their circulation to come back so that they can keep climbing because they've tied themselves so tightly with a rope. And what's happened at Shaft 10 is that people will fall and they'll fall on top of everyone else beneath them and everyone will fall to their death. 50-100 people at a time will fall to their death. That's Shaft 10. That's where the police say the miners are free to leave from. And how do we know this? Because a couple of people, a handful of people, have managed to make that journey and climb up and make it out alive. And one of them was 14, and he was interviewed at the police station. And I have the video of that, but I'm not going to share it because I wouldn't have permission to put that person's face in the public. So that's the situation at Stilfontein. And it doesn't matter how many times we say it. People are trapped, people are trapped, people are trapped. The media is misreporting on it, and not all media. I'm talking about specific outlets. And the police are lying. I was on site on Tuesday. I went to the police. I said, how do you expect people to come out? And they said, they must come through Shaft 10. And I said, you know they can't do that. And they argued with me and they spoke over me. And they said, yes, they can. It's not true. So the police are lying through their teeth about this. The state signed off on this. This is collective punishment. This is mass murder. This is torture. This goes against international law. And we're all just allowing it to happen. This is, at minimum, 10 times worse than Marikana ever was. Marikana is the single most shameful stain on our democracy's history. And this is 10 times worse, at minimum, than that was. Let's talk about the rescue operation. There is no rescue operation as we speak. The only rescue that's happening is happening by community members. So the community is pulling people out one by one. These are people who have taken a 2 kilometer or 1.6 kilometer long nylon rope, and they have a rudimentary pulley system that they use to pull people up. And they can pull 2, at most 3 people up a day. I've watched them do it. It takes hours to rescue one person. The rope itself is so heavy, let alone having a person on the end of it. And the people who are doing this work have to do it in a team of about 30 people who pull and pull and pull, and they stand close to the edge of that hole, and they have no safety harness. These are community members who are trying to save their brothers who are down there, their children who are down there. These are brave community members, and they're doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it because those are their friends. Those are their kin that are down there. The community's praying every night for the safe return of these people. There's an atmosphere of fear and intimidation in the town because the police have intimidated people, intimidated survivors. So at this rate, with at least 800 people underground, how long do you think it would take to rescue everyone if 2 people can get rescued a day? If we worked for 400 days, a year, more than a year, we'd be able to pull everyone out. And let's talk about the food that we as volunteers and activists have managed to send down there. And I'm talking about a group of very dedicated activists and volunteers working with Makua to try and fundraise what little we can. And what we've managed to fundraise has been enough to buy like a few loads of EPUB, Morvite, and basic foodstuffs. And that has been lowered down by that same volunteer group. And we received a letter from underground that said, the people are eating once a day at 6 a.m. They're eating once a day. Everyone eats a tiny amount. Not enough to keep them healthy. Not enough to save their lives. We need to start telling the truth about this. The state needs to get these people out. They need to get the machinery in place to pull these people out. And we have to put maximum pressure on them to do that. Only the state has the resources to do it.
That was South African community activist Judy Eccles speaking about the effort to save the hundreds of miners trapped at the Stilfontein abandoned gold mine shaft. To learn more, visit the website of Makua, Mining Affected Communities United in Action, at macua.org.za.
This land was barren, the lion's domain. Here he was king, over all he reigned. Then came our fathers to dig from the ground. They built us mountains to show what they found.
We see them and then we say it's just dust, but it's not. It's mountains of men.
That was Des Lindberg, Mountains of Men. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Hundreds of Amazon workers and subcontractors who are members of the Teamsters Union went on a 3-day unfair labor strike against Amazon and Jeff Bezos during Christmas. In Southern California, one of the striking workers spoke to Peter Ross of KPFK Pacifica Radio.
Hey, my name is William Overholzer. I'm working here at DAX 5 Amazon Delivery Station, City of Industry. This is out in LA, you know, greater LA County. $21.50 is just not a living wage, you know, at all. A lot of veterans, you know, here working for years, right, are still making $21.50, you know. The highest I've heard people are getting paid is $24, right? That's not life-changing money. And that's why we're out here, right? We're here for life-changing money, right? Benefits, pension, right? That we don't get from this job. We get some pretty low-tier healthcare here. I know at my DSP, right, my delivery service partner that I work for, you don't qualify for healthcare until you've worked here for a year at least, but the turnover rate's so high that like 90% of people are gone within a year. We're also fighting for benefits as well, right? I know with the Teamsters, right, they've got a standard like pension and healthcare that they have for all of their members, right? And so that would be huge for us as well. As well as lighter workload, because the workload is insane. They have us delivering, you know, sometimes upwards of 400, 500 packages in a single day, over 200 locations, right? It adds up. It adds up, right? I read a labor lab report that our local shared with us, with the drivers. It showed that DAX 5, our station, is actually the most union-busted station in the country, right? They're spending millions on these union avoidance firms, right, that they call them, paying them $475 an hour, right, over $3,000-$4,000 a day. You know, there's captive audience meetings, right? When we first started, they didn't tell us that it was voluntary, right? My boss just got us. He just told us, like, oh, there's a meeting you have to go to, right? We went in, and then the union busters are like, everyone knows this is voluntary, right? But, you know, they've got donuts and coffee there, right? So everyone's like, okay, you know, we'll stay. But no, like, after a while, right, people just started to see through it, right? Some of these union busters are so poorly trained. There's this one guy, I want to shout him out. His name is Devin. He's so bad. Right, like people try to bring up legitimate concerns with them, right? And they come off so, you know, unapologetically defensive of Amazon, right? And so anti-union, right? That people just saw through their facade, right? And they're like trying to gaslight us, tell us, no, you're third party. You can't, there's nothing you can do, right? And they stopped doing the meetings because towards the end there, right, like half the room would get up and leave, right, from time to time. We had that happen a couple times because they're just so rude, right? Like, we would ask them legitimate questions, right? And they just wouldn't answer them. They would just gaslight us, right? And it's so obvious, you know, what they were doing, so. Like, out on the strike line these past few days, we've been talking to drivers. We've realized a lot of these drivers are new. They're, like, 2 weeks new, like, 1 month new. A lot of it, I'm sure, is because this is peak season. Doesn't make sense, right? You can't get some of these drivers trained quickly enough. How they've been, you know, they've still been hiring like a week before Christmas, you know, like what's that about, you know, other than just trying to dilute numbers and trying to make up for the strike, you know. They've been offering up like an additional $200 to drivers to take on extra days, right, during the strike, right? Just a lot of incentives going around, you know. The weeks leading up to the strike, we were out in the parking lot talking to drivers because we realized, you know, a lot of these drivers, you know, they're not comfortable with these, you know, unfamiliar, you know, union reps, right, talking to them. Or they're more comfortable with, you know, with familiar faces with their fellow coworkers. So we brought the conversations to them, right? Like at the end of the route, before their route, we just would do canvassing out in the parking lot, talk to them, inform them. We would get people signed up for the strike. Right. Also got people, you know, sign vote cards, you know, for the union. But there was a lot of union busting taking place during that too. They sent out like every 30 minutes, every hour. They would send out like operations management, station management, to come out and tell us like, hey, are you guys done with your route? And we would tell them yes, right? And they're like, okay, are you loitering? Are you like what's going on? You know, we would tell them like, we're just out here talking to our, you know, our coworkers, right? And then they would tell us, oh, well, you're breaking Amazon policy. You can't be loitering. Because you're not an Amazon employee, you're not allowed to be out here in the parking lot. Of course, like, we know that's BS, right? But they would threaten us, tell us this could escalate into disciplinary action. This could lead to termination. I've had three times where they threatened to call the cops on me if I did not leave the property. Never, you know, never had cops called on us, right? But they would always make sure to use that, right, to try and scare us off, you know? We have this all recorded, right? Like, it was just heavy on intimidation, you know? There's like a GPS on you, right, 24/7 on your van. They know where you're going. They know when you take your breaks, and they know when you make mistakes, right, all the time. The surveillance technology is just looking for, like, you know, unsafe, like, driving behavior, I guess, right? If you're making hard turns, if you're accelerating hard or whatever, there's no privacy.
Yeah.
There's no privacy with this dog, yeah. And the bottles are true. The Amazon bottles are true, yeah. Yeah, the turnover rate is so insane that, you know, most people are gone within a month. You know, people don't stick around. They try to start you off easy with lighter workloads and then ease you into like a quote unquote normal route. But the normal routes are so insane for a lot of people, right? That, you know, once they've, that trial period is over and then they're hit with that first normal route, they're like, no, I think I'm good. I think I'm good. I'm moving on. This is too much. And you'd be surprised. There's a lot of older folks working this job too. There's a driver who's in their 50s working here, right? They've been working here for years and they're working a big box truck, right? They're doing large, heavy, you know, packages, delivering to businesses, kind of like, you know, like UPS drivers, right? They're delivering very heavy packages. I don't know how she does it, but just like me, she supports it, right? She needs the pension, right? She needs the benefits and all that, right? So she supports it, but at the same time, her situation is so, I understand because she's older, right? She doesn't have the freedom to stick her neck out like I can, right? So she supports in silence, you know? In San Bernardino, we have Amazon's biggest West Coast air hub, right? Just two, three weeks ago, 1,500 warehouse work. Out of 1,500 warehouse workers, they got 800 signed up, right? And they're still getting more to go, right? But now that marks us having both Amazon's biggest West Coast air hub and their biggest East Coast air hub, JFK 8, right? So, you know, and they're both on strike now. I mean, I didn't picture myself, you know, doing this like 6 months ago. This has all been like very, you know, eye-opening for me, you know, being a part of this. It's, you know, I used to feel hopeless, right? Like, you know, 6 months back that like nothing would change with this job, you know, but, you know, the Teamsters came through, started talking to them, started organizing. And in just a matter of a few months, I've been able to get, you know, can't give exact numbers, right? But we've gotten a lot of our coworkers signed up, right? A lot of our coworkers support it, right? And right, the only way you can do that is if you get organized, you know. And you know, it's been a lot of fun, right? Like, Amazon doesn't really have a friendly culture here, you know. But ever since the union came in, right, we've been organizing, right. Like now, it feels like there's a real sense of community, you know. Workers are no longer just clocking in, clocking out like mindless drones, right? Now people are hanging out now, you know, talking to coworkers, right, building relationships. I think that's been the best part about it.
That was an Amazon worker in Southern California speaking to KPFK's Peter Ross. In a successful strike, 2,500 striking San Francisco Unite Here Local 2 hotel workers ended their strike after 93 days. A major issue was healthcare union benefits. Hilton hotel workers talked to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about their struggle and the issue of healthcare.
What did you learn in the strike?
The main thing for me is after I worked 39 years in the Hilton Hotel, and they want me to pay for my health care. So basically, I'm going to inside the work, make money for them, and pay for my own health care. That's a no-no.
One of the things is there's a big health care, J.P. Morgan Healthcare Workers Conference here in January
13th. That's the worst one. And we are here fighting for the health care, and they come in to invest the health care. Hey, guys, put some more money, and you're going to make money for these people. Last month, my wife went inside the physical check. And then they sent us a bill, just a physical check, just a doctor touch a little bit. It's like $600. And then we had to pay five something, and the Medicare pay 100 something. It's crazy. We got to fix the system. I mean, America got to need to fix the system. And now we are settled down, so let back to work and to survive, to help the family a little bit. And looking forward for the future and see in next 4 years, see what's going on.
We are done with the strike. We have 93 days outside fighting for our contract. But now we are okay. We resigned the contract. We're almost coming back to work. We are so happy because we work together to build this power with the union.
Did you have solidarity during the strike?
Yes, I have 93 years outside in the street fighting for our rights.
And they wanted to take away your health care benefits, the hotels?
Oh, yeah, they want to take it out, but now they have some deals that is good for us and for our family, too.
You know, we want these companies to continue coming. We would hate to be on strike if JP Morgan comes and we're still out in the cold, you know? As a union and the company need to come together and find better solutions for the insurance because it's getting out of hand. It's getting out of hand.
And that was a big issue in the strike.
That was the biggest issue. I think that it hasn't even, you know, that was the tip of the iceberg, you know, like the most important one. As a family man and a father of your kids, you know, you want the best for them in case anything happens. They get hurt, they get sick. You want to have the health care. If not, it just all goes down the drain, you know?
And these companies are trying to take it away.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Like, they can afford it. They can't afford it. They have so many properties, so many hotels. They keep buying. While we were on strike, they were buying land and they were buying hotels. And that's ridiculous, you know? How can you do that? Every day, all day. Just like us, we were outside every day, all day, all night.
What do you think of it?
Ah, beautiful. Perfect. This is what we call Christmas. Merry Christmas.
And is it worth it, going on strike?
Yeah. Worth it. You know, all our efforts, or, you know, it's very good. It's very good. We have to fight what we're fighting for, you know. We need it.
Who we are! Volunteer!
That was Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer with a report about San Francisco Hilton hotel workers who won their strike after 93 days and defended their health care benefits from the hotels who wanted to take away their union plan and put in a plan run by the insurance industry.
I woke up feeling great. The birds are in the trees. They're singing me a melody. La 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 for the bullies. My head is on straight. My heart is in peace, my soul is incredibly ready to change history. It's a good day to fight the system,
to fight the system. We're gonna spread the love, we're gonna spread it round. We're all over the city now, and way down in the underground. Come on!
It's a good day to fight the system,
to fight the system.
That was Sean Godzo. It's a good day to fight the system. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, we hear from Kalonji Changa of Black Power Media and veteran Black Panther Party member Doruba Bin Wahad on the transitioning of Black Panther Party member and former political prisoner, their comrade Bilal Suni Ali, who was also a member of Gil Scott Heron's Midnight Band.
One of our OGs and comrades in our People's Liberation Movement went on to join the ancestors, and that being Bilal Suni Ali, a veteran freedom fighter, veteran Panther, and BLA fighter, also a cultural icon in regards to the work he did as a world-renowned sax player and flautist, most notably with Gil Scott Heron, as far as the member of the Midnight Band. You know, so we say, rise in power to Bilal Suni Ali, who is one of the reasons why, you know, I'm still in Atlanta. So Daruba, you know, starting off this year, we've had a few comrades join the ancestors. We want to start off by acknowledging, you know, our brother, Jazz Hayden, who made his transition this past January, along with our brother, Baba Sekou Odinga, one of your close comrades, and we're ending off with Bilal Suni Ali. Of course, there were many folks in between, but you know, I just wanted to kind of point them out in particular. If you don't mind, you know, starting off, share a few words about Baba Bilal, you know, a few thoughts.
Well, you know, from around we come and to allow me to return. Bilal Suni Ali, you know, He was one of the original members of Gil Scott Heron's band, you know, and he was also in the Black Panther Party. And Bilal has dedicated himself not only to expressing culturally struggle for African liberation, but also by working studiously in building organizational solidarity around Black political prisoners, Pan-African, New African political prisoners. And he had a show, a podcast, that emphasized that struggle and brought out much of the history of the radical tradition. And I think that his passing should cause many of us, especially Muslims, young Muslims, to understand the connection between opposing imperialism and white supremacy, how important a link that is in our being as Muslims. We are encouraged, indeed, urged by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to stand up for the poor, to stand up for the weak and hungry and struggling on their behalf. And Bilal was one of those brothers that spent his whole adult life doing that. He was also married to Fulani Sunni Ali, who was a matriarch in the Black Liberation Movement and the Republic of New Africa. She passed a few years ago, and they have children who are themselves children of the movement, of the struggle, and they are carrying forward the legacy of their mother and father in the struggle for African liberation. So I just express my sadness because, as you pointed out, we have had seen comrades transitioning over the past year. Sekou Odinga transitioned. Sekou Odinga was, in many ways, a legend, you know, in our struggle.
That was veteran Black Panther Party member Doruba Bin Wahad and Kalonji Changa of Black Power Media lifting up Bilal Sunni Ali, Black Panther Party member, former political prisoner, and member of Gil Scott-Heron's Midnight Band. Bilal was also a contributor to this show, Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, sharing his work to free political prisoner Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly H-Rap Brown. Here's Bilal Sunni Ali performing Look for Me in the Whirlwind live at Burning Books in Buffalo, New York. That concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, Akua Holt, Peter Ross, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.